Thank you.
Well, it's an extraordinary privilege to have Yegor Gaidar here to give this year's Robbins Memorial Lectures. And when I think about it, I feel that Lionel Robbins would have been more thrilled than almost anybody that Russia should have had, as its prime minister, a great liberal economist. And it's really wonderful that we have Iris Robbins here to celebrate this occasion. Now, when I first met Yegor, which was actually less than 2 years ago, he wasn't a politician at all. He was director of an academic research institute. But of course, he was preparing, and he had gathered around him there a group of remarkable people who were clearly the most suited group to be the first reform government of Russia. And I think it was a real mark of the greatness of Yeltsin that he chose this group for that task. Well, all the world knows what revolutionary changes Yegor and his team brought in. Of course, there was pain, and that, I think, makes it all the more remarkable that 10 days ago the Russian people voted in the second question of the referendum to endorse the economic and social policies which Yegor had brought in. And I think that that is the measure of his achievement. And I think the way to think of it is that he changed the mindset of a people. And I was telling him earlier my own direct experience of my 75-year-old neighbor, Faina. When Yegor began his work, she actually used the word devil to describe him. Can you imagine? But by the end, he was, by the end of last year, she considered him a hero. And I think that she's typical of millions and millions of Russians. So that now it's clear that Yegor is the most loved politician in Russia after the president. And I will give you again a little illustration from my experience the week before the referendum, when, of course, I asked every taxi driver what they thought. And two of them said, just out of the blue, that Gaidar was the best thing that ever happened to Russia. I would add that one of them said that, of course, it is vital that a prime minister be a qualified economist. I don't think that the same opinion is held as widely as it should be in other countries. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we are really privileged to have with us one of the great figures of our age. And Yegor will talk for about 50 minutes, and then we'll have questions. And I'm delighted to ask him to give his lecture.
Dear ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege for me to address this audience. I would like today really to discuss the matters that are going prior to the transformation that in which we have a chance to take a part in Russia. The questions connected with the previous years of economic turmoil before the beginning of the year 92. Well, now, after the long economic dispute about what is the better, socialism and or capitalism is or plan or the market is a little bit out of the fashion, the new dispute about the advantages, comparative advantages of the shock treatment or gradualism are step by step taking their place. Of course, it's quite clear for me that this debate of what is the best strategy for the transformation of the post-communist economies will last for the years. Of course, it is very easy to make a case for the gradualism. Just comparing the experience of the China or Vietnam with the rapidly expanding production, social stability, GDP growth higher than 10%, and the experience of Russia or Eastern Europe going through the very difficult period of structural transformation. Well, it is not difficult, by the way, to make the opposite case. Using the experience of the countries of the previous Soviet Union, of the Eastern Europe, making it clear that those of them who tried to use the gradual approach are now in the worst possible situation, making it especially evident on the case of Ukraine or Romania, for instance, or, by the way, stressing that those who were the leaders of the reform process, like Poland or Czechia, now are evidently clearer than anybody to the beginning of the economic growth. All the same, it is clear that this discussion probably could not be really resolved on the Orwellian principle of two legs good, four legs bad, or vice versa. It is clear for me that this discussion will last for years, and I would not at all try to pretend that I am prepared to finish it. But I would just like to stress your attention to the few points that are relatively clear from my point of view, especially when experience of our country and the countries that previously was incorporated in the Soviet Union. First of all, there was no communist authoritarian government that tried the shock treatment approach. The closest to it probably was Mr. Rakowski government in Poland in the year 89, and without any sensible success. It is also clear that it was no democratic, non-communist, non-authoritarian government that tried gradual approach with any success whatsoever. The governments of Romania and Ukraine probably are the best examples. It is the question in which you cannot really separate the political and economical issues. They are too strongly combined. From my point of view, it is evident that the gradual approach to the communist economy transformation is the possible strategy of a rather far-seeing communist authoritarian regime, which is trying to adopt the new realities. Probably the only possible strategy for this kind of regime. The strategy that has some possibility of success, especially if it is undertaken with the high earlier from the point of view of the stage of development of the country, and with a well-elaborated strategy. The shock treatment usually is the only possible alternative, sensible alternative, for the post-communist government that comes to power after, because of the bad choice of the strategy or because of the bad luck, the communist regime fails with this attempt of the gradual economic transformation. So practically it is not the choice of the strategy for a different type of political regime. It is the different kind of the political situation in which different kind of the economic policy could be promoted. Of course, when Mr. Gorbachev came to power in the year 89, it was absolutely clear that any serious discussion about shock treatment and about very radical economic reform is politically absolutely out of the question. It was a very stable society in which practically all of the members of the society were absolutely sure that it will last for the years and the decades. If you would try to find somebody in Soviet Union or Russia who would really believe then in a 10 years period of time Soviet Union will disappear, we will be living in the mostly privatized economy, etc., it would not even be funny. It would not be the problem for the discussion. The strongest political point of Mr. Gorbachev always was his ability to manage the compromise in the ruling elite. If you would see how he managed the big meetings in which the leaders of the regions, party organization, biggest factories, branch ministers were present, and when some serious issue of the economic policy was discussed, you will be fascinated by his arts of making it the discussions, manipulating the discussions in a way in which the decision somehow will go as if it is accepted by the majority. And he would just as if deal as if he's accepting this decision. It was a very interesting art, but also it created very serious problems for a political leader who adopt this kind of political attitude. Because that means that he cannot be very far away from the horizon, from the real preferences of the political elite. He have to follow the occasions, he has to follow problems. He cannot go few steps ahead of the situation. At the year 85, it was clear that the situation in Russia is very stable, and the stability is most striking characteristic of the society at all. It was relatively stable from the point of view of macroeconomy and finance and money society. The rates of the money increase were rather stable and on the low level. Budget deficit non-existent. Short time period of the increased inflationary pressures, the latest of which was well seen at the end of the 70s, around 78-79, usually would be eliminated by the increase of the prices of the luxury, tighter control over the wages, and the increased import of consumer durables or consumer luxuries. It was the society with a very, very stable structure of the economy. Usually, for instance, the composition of the investment in the different branches of the economy that existed in the year 75 or even 70 would be absolutely duplicated in the beginning of 80s. If it is usual to spend, for instance, on agriculture 26% of the investment, it would be spent in the year 70, in the year 75, in the year 80, in the year 89. If it is usual, for instance, to spend on the machine building industry the exact number of the total investment in the industry, it will be absolutely constant during all of the years, absolutely irregardless of the effect of this investment. For instance, the most striking example was the investment in our big water redistribution irrigation projects. We used to spend on the irrigation projects per year approximately the same amount of money that was invested in the civil machine building industry, and approximately, for instance, 10 times more than we invested in the communications. During 20 years that there was no visible results and improvements in the harvest, etc., connected with these huge irrigational projects. But it was absolutely out of the question, for instance, to cut down, at least by the few percent, this investment, because it was done so a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, and 10 years ago. It was the society in which the stability of prices, especially the stabilities of the prices on the basic consumer commodities was a kind of a religious, has some religious value for the ruling elite. After the year 62, when the communist government decided to increase a little bit the prices for meat and milk products, which resulted in the first serious riots on the Russian territory during the communist rule. The idea that you just cannot touch the prices for the basic commodities was absolutely out of dispute on the political level. After the events in Poland in the year 70, when the fall of Gomułka government was connected with the change of the meat prices, it was absolutely forbidden to discuss the problems connected with the possibility of the changes of the consumer good prices. Well, of course, by itself, it created more and more serious problems for the economy. The society and the ruling elite had to pay more and more for this stability, for this immobility of the economy. And only most evident results, for instance, was constantly increasing subsidies as a share of the GDP, approaching 8% at the beginning of 85. It was the increase of the import of the agricultural commodities financed by the old oil export. It was all the same in the presence of all of these cases, the increase of the shortages of the these products on the consumer good market because of the increase of the demand for these products. But the stability should not be undermined at any price. It was also evident that the country is once more losing its long-term economic competition with the most dynamic, rapidly developing economies of the world. Machine building industry was evidently incompatible in the world market. The keeping oil production on the constant level costed more and more from the point of view of the investment. Agriculture was in a long-term crisis and the enormous investment in the sector that was spent during the 20 years between the year 65 and the year 95 evidently have provided very unimpressive results. So it was clear that the society and the economy is stable. Nothing is really pushing the ruling elite to change anything, but if we will keep this strategy of stability at all price, it will mean that the lag between the most developing countries and Russia will increase step by step. That was really the turning point for the discussion in the ruling elite at the moment of the nomination of the Gorbachev. Should we use more and more the great innovation of the previous generation, the stability? Or should we try once more to catch up with the development of rapidly going forward Western economies? Well, Russia was confronted with the problems of catching up development, as you probably know, the third time during the later century. Every time with a very serious, long-term political and economical consequences. First time it was at the 70s of the 19th century, when after the elimination of the serfdom, it proved evident that by itself, elimination of the serfdom does not provide necessary inputs that will encourage the rapid development of the Russian economy. In that period, Russia, for the first time, were evidently confronted with its most serious long-term problem of the low level of the private savings and the private investment. The peasants tied in община, without the clear property rights on the land, without the clear property rights on the incomes, with the very specific tax base that practically was the tax on the most efficient production, of course had not any serious stimuli to save or invest. The gentry, with its long-term tradition of excessive demonstrative consumption, of course was not really the agent that could be the source of the flow of the savings for this economy. A weak budget, monetary instability undermined the possibilities of bringing here the foreign investment on the large scale. It was the time when Russia once more applied the idea of the investment financed by huge governmental savings and governmental investment, based first of all on the strong increase of the government take, first of all of the increase of the taxation of the peasants by the indirect taxes. That was used then to finance the railroad construction, to finance the creation of the national industry, and then protected first of all by the import barriers, etc. So Russia embarked on the way of government-led import substitution industrialization. It was a relative economic success, but economic success with combined with enormous social risks, because it was always economic success based on excessive taxation of an impoverished countryside. The slogan of this period was, we will not eat enough, but we'll export. The grain export of Russia was really the basis for the establishment of the gold reserves and financial stability. Practically, it was a competition with approaching peasant revolution. Which will come first? The development of the national capitalism will have its own start, will create the possibilities of lowering down the role of the state in the Russian development. And it looked like if between the year 7 and the 13, after the first Russian revolution, it looked like as if it succeed with this task. But the history proved another way. The country, of course, could not survive the First World War, and the Russian Revolution was the reaction, of course, by the way, to this strategy of government-led industrialization. The second time we were faced with the same question at the end of the 20s, when after the revolution it was more or less evident that Russia is facing very similar problems we were facing before the big financial reforms. Well, if you will read the Russian literature, emigrated literature of the 20s, or the cleverest professional journals of the 20s in Russia, there was a whispered view that now we have a case of more or less capitalist development under the socialist slogans. Well, the majority of the economy, of course, is the peasant countryside and the small-scale industry. There is a market working. Of course, it is restricted, but all the same, it operates. The most serious problems, once more, was the problems of the savings and the private savings and the private investments. Well, with the strong socialist ideology, it was useless to hope for the huge savings and investment of the broadest strata of the population of the peasantry. Even Bukharin was not prepared to fight for his slogan, enrich yourself, addressed to the peasants, because politically and socially it was unacceptable. And it was useless to hope, for instance, that the peasant will self-save and invest just to be included into the political enemies and to be the subject for the political repression. So it was clear that the peasant will not be the source of the investment and savings. The same was very much characteristic for the city entrepreneurs. The political instability of the situation created for them the strong stimulus to free the capital abroad, to engage in a short-term operation, but not for long-term investments. With the foreign investments, the situation was clear. It was hopeless to expect them after the abolition of the Tsarist debts. And with the state industry, it was also very difficult to hope that it will be a serious source of the investments because of, for the political reason, the increase of the wages to the city proletariat was much higher than the increase of the productivity. So the Stalin once more was faced with the Vita dilemma, and he answered to this dilemma with a very strong development innovation, which had enormous influence on the general development and the world economy in this 20th century. Well, there is, in the market economy, there is a very important and evident limits on the amount and the possibilities of governmental savings. If you are financing the savings, governmental savings, enormous governmental savings, with the high taxes, then the high taxes influence strongly and negatively on the general level of the economic activity. If you are financing the excessive governmental savings with the from the inflationary sources, then inflation by itself encourages the flee of capital and discourages the long-term investments. So we are removing the micro instruments of the market economy. We are eliminating the market from the as a major instrument that deals with the micro connections, micro coordinations of the activity of the enterprise. We are incorporating all of the enterprises into the big hierarchical structures, and they are selling or buying the goods not because they would like to do it, but because they have an orders from the boss. Then your investments are independent anymore on the stimulus. They are a result of the decision of the government. The huge amount of the government take does not anymore discourage your investments. You don't need stimuli. The strong financial control prevent anything like the capital flight. Elimination of the huge inequality, enormous inequality that is characteristic for the young capitalism or for the old authoritarian regime creates some additional legitimacy to this policy. And then, of course, all of it is strongly combined with the totalitarian political control, which creates possibilities preventing the wage increases, any independent trade union activity, etc. So practically, it makes the development independent on the internal savings, private savings rate or private investment rate. It's now governmental-led growth that can be sustained on a rather high level for a historically long period of time. Well, if we are now looking at the historic experience with this type of growth, we can see that it plays approximately as an anabolic. It creates the possibility to win the competition, but destroy, in the long-term perspective, it destroys your economic organism. It creates the possibility for rather for high economic growth, but it creates enormous problems, long-term problems, with which you will have to deal in the latest decades. Well, just a few of these problems. First of all, it eliminates the source of independent flow of innovation created by the micro market mechanism. Then it led to the enormous bureaucratization of entire economic life. You need enormous bureaucracy which is running these day-to-day transactions, which are usually made by the market. This enormous bureaucratization by itself creates enormous problems of the coordination of economic activity. When you have a developed, complicated industrial structures in which every transactions are made not because of the economic stimuli, but because of the order, you're faced with enormous organizational problems. And you're trying to avoid, to resolve these organizational problems by, first of all, by minimizing change, so by avoiding any innovation if you can avoid them, and then by stabilization of all of the elements of the economy. So if any branch of the economy is formed, it usually will survive. It is the slogan usually used to discuss the problems connected, for instance, with inefficient industries or inefficient enterprises in Russia. It is, I don't know even how to tell it in English, it is usually told, это нечастная лавочка. If the enterprise is inefficient, it does produce the products that is absolutely useless. It is это нечастная лавочка. It does not mean that it should be closed or the resources should be redistributed. It is the part of the state organism. It should be protected. It should be supplied, etc. You will see that practically during the period of time after the first stage of industrialization, when the basics of the industrial structure were formed, you will not find any industry in Russia, the resources from which were redistributed to other industries, in which, for instance, the production was cut because there was no demand for these products, or because there was another way of production more efficient than this. If any industry was installed, it is the part of the state apparatus and it is entitled to get its own share of the resources. This economy could be dynamic and could have a high level of the growth until there was a source of the resources that could be used to create this new industrial structure. Practically, there was one source. It was countryside. That was the private agriculture that was converted to the collective and state agriculture. That was really the financial source, the material source of the resources that were used during the period of industrialization. Until these resources was present, and for instance in China they was present at the beginning of the reform, you have rather dynamically, from the point of view of the rates of growth, developing economy. When, for instance, in Russia, it was clear that there's no more resources from the countryside that could be accumulated through the state budget and used in the industrialization, that was really the beginning of the crisis of this model of the economic growth. Because from this period, when especially it was evident that you now have to invest to the agriculture, to give resources, to support it, etc., it was quite clear that this structure is immobile and just could not develop anymore. Well, in the year 85, it was the most the basic characteristic of the situation was more or less clear to those who are making decisions. Well, it was clear also that it is absolutely useless to try to resolve this on this particular occasion, the traditional Russian problems, on the traditional Russian way, by additional governmental savings, by additional governmental investments, by any macro movements, because all of the problems not on the macro but on the micro level. All of the problems are connected with the fact of that without market mechanism you cannot fight with this increasing paralysis of the economic mechanisms, with the sclerotic outcomes. It is more or less clear what generally the Gorbachev government should do if it would really like to elaborate the sensible strategy of the gradualist transformation. It should have tried, first of all, to preserve the basic and strongest characteristic of the system, the financial stability. Should try to protect, at least for a time being, the present level of the governmental saving and investment, and should try step by step to incorporate the new market mechanisms that would make the system more adaptable, more innovation, etc., more innovative, etc. It is unclear for me whether it was possible or impossible to use practically this strategy, but the first movements of the political elite in the Gorbachev times was in the absolutely opposite direction. Well, once more, the elite tries to use old-style solution of the Russian problems, of the problems of the Russian growth. Well, what are the most evident problems? The most evident problems that is the slowdown of economic growth. Why the slowdown? Well, of course, because these old men have not kept the discipline on the high level. There is a lot of drunkenness in the working force. And then, of course, it's insufficient investment. We should invest more in the machine building. We should invest more in the agriculture. We should invest more in energy sector, etc. So let us try. Well, of course, it is evident. These old men just were unable to do anything. But we are younger, we are more energetic, now we'll do it. So, just with a few first movement, the Gorbachev government undermines the basic foundation of the financial stability that was kept in Russia approximately from the year 46-47. The alcohol, tax on the alcohol, the revenues from the foreign trade because of the change from the consumer durables to the consumer goods to the investment goods, and then the level of the government expenditure on the investment. The attempt to increase the rates of increase of investment approximately three times from 3% on the year 85 to 8.4% in the year 86, combined with this occurrence, created enormous financial disbalances. By the year 87, the financial stability was all in the past. The budget deficit was not anymore 1% of the GDP, it was approaching 7%. There was a very rapid increase of the money creation. And the result of it on the consumer good market was a very rapid impoverishing of the consumer market. The goods that were present on the markets for decades in easy supply were one by one being eliminated from the market. Spoon, detergent, various items that were to which the population was accustomed. Well, it was clear that by the year 87 that this first attempt to increase the rates of the economic growth by the new additional investments is not producing the best possible results, let us put it this way. So probably we should do something more. Probably we are not doing enough. What should we do? Probably there is some problems in our economic mechanism. Probably our economy really is not working too good. Well, at the moment, for instance, in the year 87, such words like market, for instance, or liberalization, especially liberalization of the prices, are all the same, absolutely out of the possibility of the discussion in the political elite. And as I have mentioned, it is crucial for the Gorbachev. He cannot discuss the problems that are absolutely out of reach of political elite. So, but what could be discussed? What are the subjects that are usually, first of all, addressed in the political elite when it is discussing the problems connected with the micro level? Well, as in an army, there is a crucial roles, like for instance in Russian army, the role of the regiment commander. Everybody should, who would like to make it a military career, should be regiment commander, or he will not go far away. There is such a role in Russian hierarchy, and that is the role of the enterprise director. Usually, any party secretary of the regional party committee or the branch minister, etc., should, at least for a short period of time, be a enterprise director. It is the place in which the nomenklatura personnel is being in a shortest contact with the real life. And the experience of the enterprise director practically creates the model for the dealing with the economy. They are usually looking at the economy with the eyes of the enterprise director. And it is clear for the enterprise director what really creates a problem in the economy. Of course, he is dissatisfied with the fact that the profit is being redistributed and that he cannot use his own profit. It is also clear for him, of course, that if he is getting losses, the state should compensate these losses, but it is another story. It is clear for him that it is an enormous problem that he cannot freely dispose of his products to sell all these products to those who would, from his point of view, will be the most suitable buyers. It is also quite clear that the state should put the things in this way that those who have to sell the products to him will supply these products and did not try to sell it to any other. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, for instance, if you would like to speak about the economic reform in the terms of price liberalization, introduction of the market, you will be confronting the political elite. If you will put it in the way of the discussion of the increasing of the powers of the enterprise directors, you will get enormous support. Everybody would agree with you. So, the next stage of the economic transformation, the discussion on which is centered on the year 87, and the practical implementation starts in the year 99, is the reform of the state management connected with the increase of the powers of the state enterprise directors. With the law of the state enterprises, practically we are getting a very unusual situation. It is a terrible blow to the most principle basical norms of the old hierarchical economy. Complete dependence on the member of the hierarchy from his boss. The inevitability of fulfilling the orders. Now, the state orders are voluntary. The enterprise director can ever either take them or refuse to take them. Some portion of the profit could not be redistributed by the state. It should rest with the enterprise. The enterprise director has a power of полное хозяйственное ведение. I don't even know how to express it in English. It is some very specific property rights without any obligations. Then you can even not dismiss the enterprise director. You should then ask the working collective of the enterprise, would they be ready to support the dismissal of the enterprise director? All of this has on the working of the Russian economy approximately the same influence as if, for instance, you would try to introduce the military form under which you will proclaim the right of the regiment commander to sell the military equipment, to dispose freely of the incomes, to choose with which he would like to fight, and then to make it possible to dismiss the regiment commander if all of the regiment would support this dismissal. So it is practically the final blow to the basic characteristic of the system necessary to manage the repressed inflation. So practically, we, first of all, we destroyed the financial stability. We drastically increased the level of repressed inflation, the level of the shortages, and then the second step, we are destroying the institutes, the mechanism that were especially implemented in the socialist economy to deal with the situation of repressed inflation. You wouldn't be surprised that the results would be disastrous, because the other mechanism, the free prices, the system of the markets, the property right, are absent. Formally, the prices are fixed. So you get, first of all, of course, there is some tradition. Practically, the enterprises are listening to the branch ministries, at least for some time. The regional party organization have a possibility to impose something on them, but with each month, smaller and smaller and smaller. So from the year 89, it is evident that step by step, the possibility of managing the economy is smaller, and the amount of the distortion is higher. Well, the Gorbachev is in a very difficult situation. Now, it is evident, more or less for everybody, that something is wrong. Well, they invented everything okay. Every step was supported by the political elite. Every step was absolutely right. But somehow, the result is disastrous. You cannot buy any products anymore in Russian shops. The situation is on the plants is developing from the worst to the worst, etc. Somebody has to be responsible. And also in the party organization, in the highest party structures, there is a feeling that probably the Gorbachev is too weak with the press. There is too much of the discussions. It was also the slogan of the period: "Пресса подраспустилась." Well, the press is behaving too freely. So the Gorbachev remembers, of course, very well the experience of his very energetic predecessor, Mr. Khrushchev, who was dismissed by the plenum of the Central Committee. When you are have in touch with the party, high-ranking party officials, at the moment you can feel the hatred to the Gorbachev and the preparation to remove him. So he decides once to make an enormous political jump and try to create new political basis for himself. This basis could not be really the party organization anymore as it was before. He would try to make another basis. Semi-democratical parliament would support the first democratical Russian president, or the chairman of the Supreme Soviet. So the third stage is the beginning of a large-scale political reform that changed the distribution of the power in the Soviet society. This change goes in the period of enormous economical crisis that is very well felt. The first and most evident result of these further steps in the direction of political liberalization from the economical point of view is, of course, the explosion of the social expectations. If you will reread the first slogans, the programs of those who were being promoted to the people's deputies on the first free Russian elections, you would see that they were promising everything with a zero cost. They were promising to cut down taxes. They were promising to increase drastically the expenditure for all of the social needs, not to cut subsidies, not to increase consumer good prices, to increase the expenditure from the pension, for the health care, for everything. And after this election, of course, the first result is an explosion of the social expenditure. So any attempt of controlling the finance, of controlling the budget, after this are evidently fruitless. So the third step in this direction is the start of the economic reforms in the center of a terrible, of very serious economic crisis. After this, it is more or less evident that any serious discussions about the gradual transformation of the Russian economy is absolutely out of the place. There is no real control over the resource flow, no real control over the financial flows. Their economy is very rapidly developing in the directions of the direct barter trade and house. That is the period in which, when it is evident that you cannot go radically forward, you cannot go backward. There is usually the period of the economic programs, and then the period of the great Russian programs of economic reform starts. It was the period from the end of the year 89 until the summer of the year 91, when we have approximately 15 officially liberated, officially discussed, usually adopted programs of economic reforms without any serious consequences for the economic behavior or for the economic life. It is, of course, it is evident for everybody that it is nothing practical in all of these programs. Well, the reaction on this economic crisis is, first of all, the further division of the powers, the lack of power of the union, the increasing economic mass creates enormous stimuli for the grab of the power on the republican level. What is especially important for the Russian economy starts the fight for the popularity between the new Russian government and the new Russian parliament, and the union government and the union parliament. In this fight, which is especially important during the year 1991, every counterpart tries to adopt the most popular solution. Union parliament adopt the very generous pension law that seriously increase the general level of pensions. The Russian government adopts even more generous pension law. Union government cuts down the profit tax to the 45% from the previous 55%. Russian government's parliament cuts down the profit tax to the 38%. Union government cuts the profit tax to the 35%. Russian parliament cuts it to the 32%. And the similar developments in the various fields of economic life that make absolutely impossible to manage. Well, the union government evidently have no idea how to deal with the situation, is trying very extravagant moves like attempt of the monetary reform at the beginning of the year 1991. Which confiscated approximately 3% of the cash money and undermined drastically the demand for money and the public belief in the monetary stability with enormous additional inflationary consequences. First of all, at last, after the long negotiations, after it is evident that the financial situation is unresolvable, union government take responsibility for the first in the 30 years increase of the consumer good prices at the year in the April of the year 91. But then it has no any more apparatus of grabbing the initial incomes connected with the increase of these prices. So in 3 months' time, in approximately July, we are approximately the same situation from the point of view of the consumer good markets. You can buy nothing, even with the higher prices. There are the same shortages of everything in Moscow. The August coup, of course, was the evident attempt of the old elite to remake the situation, to change it drastically, to reintroduce the old style mechanism of political control, economic control and financial control, and on this basis to draw the history back. The failure of this coup drastically changed the situation. The first result of this coup was the complete destruction of everything that was rest from the previous mechanisms of the governmental control. Well, it somehow was possible to survive and manage the economy because the power of the regional party committees were relatively strong on the micro level. They managed at least to grab some resources from the enterprises. After the August, this party committee would have zero possibility of doing anything. Well, at least by the tradition, enterprises would take into account the position of the union branch ministries, because Russian government would only run approximately 7% of the Russian economy. Rest was run by the union ministries. After the coup, the legitimacy of the union ministries involved with the coup was zero. So nothing doing. The young Russian government had no legitimacy in the eyes, from the point of view of the regional Soviets, in which the communists has a majority. It has no apparatus with which it is possible to manage the economy. In Russia, usually the political and economical crises are expressed in the crisis of the grain supply to the big cities. It was so in the time of the February Revolution and October Revolution. It was so at the end of the 20s. The first very evident reaction after the August coup was the drop of the amount of the grain accumulated by the state procurement organization next week after the coup, approximately 4 times from the weeks before the coup. So we are approaching the very severe and the very evident crisis of the grain supply, of the bread supply of the big cities, with which it was very difficult to find how to manage. To try to use the old style mechanism was, of course, absolutely fruitless attempt. To discuss in this situation the possibilities of gradual approach to the Russian economic reform could only the people which would understand nothing at all in what happens in Russia after the August of the year 91. Well, but if you would not mind, I would stop at this moment and we will discuss, if you would also agree, the problems connected with the elaboration of the reform program tomorrow. Thank you.
Well, what a wonderful description of the problem. And next time we will have the solution. I think this has been a great experience, and everybody must have thoughts and questions which they would like to share with Yegor. Who would like to start?
Sorry, this one.
Well, the elements of market, of course, existed in the Soviet economy even before the Gorbachev came to power, in the different sectors of the economy. First of all, of course, there is some segments of the market in the foodstuffs connected with so-called collective farms markets. So it was more or less market prices. At least you can buy foodstuffs with these prices, etc. Then, of course, the market of the labor force was probably the most was under the most serious influence of the direct market relationships. For instance, the enterprises, the branch ministries would play a role of competitors on the labor force market because of the shortages, of the usual shortage of the labor force, trying to use the different kind of stimuli like wages, government official flats, accesses to the goods in shortage to grab the necessary amount of labor. And for instance, the state restrictions that are being imposed, for instance, on the wages were inefficient just because they have to compete for the additional labor force. Of course, there was an elements of the market in the transactions between the enterprises that are formally being organized by the state decrees. Usually, the state would issue more decrees, more orders for the goods than really it was possible to produce. Then the producer would have to choose to whom really to supply the goods. And then the consumer will have to pursue the seller, the producer, that he is the best possible customer. Then the creation of the ties in this economy would at least somehow be connected with more or less unorganized and formal markets, etc. So of course market existed in this economy, but usually on the periphery of this economy and with a very, very specific forms.
Could the communist regime have saved itself by following the Chinese example, particularly in starting by liberalizing agricultural production and distribution of
feedstock? Well, I just would like to remind you that Gorbachev tried to do exactly this. One of the first things he declared was the attempt to liberalize the agriculture and encourage the reform in the agriculture. It was done from first time in the year 1985 and then in the year 86. He tried to encourage some reforms in the agriculture. But the result of this attempt was very close to zero. Why so striking difference with the Chinese example when these reforms produced enormous results from the point of view of the increase of the average harvest, efficiency of the agriculture, etc.? Probably, from my point of view, it is connected with the different stages of the development of the socialist economy and, first of all, of the socialist agriculture. Well, during the six decades, the Russian countryside was left without the resources of the most qualified, most socially active labor force. For any youngster born in the countryside that is clever and talented, it was absolutely clear that the best possible life strategy he can adopt is to, at every cost, to migrate to the big city. Because the incomes in the countryside would be a few times lower, because the possibility of the social promotions will be much lower, there will be legal restrictions on the migration until the 50s, etc., etc., etc. So practically,
during the 60 years, we had a constant outflow of all of the socially adaptable population from the countryside. And when, after these 6 years, you're addressing the countryside and telling, well, now let us start the radical reforms here. With whom? It is not only the case that there is a confrontation, that collective farms chairmans or the chairman of the boards or the directors of the state farm would oppose this reform. It is the case that there is no strong social movement that will support, that will respond to this reform. Well, for instance, when on the different stage of the Russian countryside development, Lenin introduced the NEP. The result was evident and in a very short term. It was another countryside. When the Gorbachev tried to do reforms on the same similar direction, the response was very small. Even now, when we are the most serious problems we are facing in our countryside reform, not because we are not trying, we are trying hard. But because of the fact that we are getting very, very limited response. Our most serious hopes mostly are connected with the remigrations to the countryside of those migrants from the countryside of the first or second generation. Many of the new farmers' units are created not by those who are living in the countryside, but those who left the countryside 10 years ago, were not adapted in the cities, especially in the present industrial crisis, and now is prepared to go there.
The lady.
Well, I think that if we are speaking, for instance, about the Gorbachev, I think that the summer of the year 88 was the period of the change of his attitude and aspirations. At the beginning of the summer, on the 90th party conference, he is confident, very confident in himself. He's sure that everything goes right. There is some small problems, but we'll correct them. When, for instance, academician Balkin try in a very, very modest words express his doubts that probably something in the economic strategy may be not perfect at all, enough. He was the object of the very severe criticism of those present on the conference, including the Gorbachev. Then Gorbachev comes to the countryside on one of his usual journeys. This journey is this time to the Krasnoyarsk region. He's accustomed, generally the people feeling until the spring of the 88 toward the Gorbachev generally are good. Well, the understanding that really something is wrong only this time approach the population. So that is the first time when he is not getting the usual greetings and applauses, etc., but the harsh question he have to explain, he doesn't get a response, etc. He comes back from Krasnoyarsk trip, and it is clear that he's trying to find what really goes wrong. He's trying to gather new gatherings and getting the new ideas. Let us increase the implementation of the leasing. Let us increase the investment to the agriculture. Let us put all of our attention to the consumer good industry, etc., etc. And he sees that it is not probably the right solution. So from my point of view, from the autumn of the year 88, he really get the understanding that something is wrong with his economic policy.
In your speech, in the second half of your speech, you notice
Well, from my point of view, it was not personal. It was really the struggle between competing political elites, first of all, using the instrument in this battle. So it was, from my point of view, nothing personal in it. With the different leaders, probably the parliament would behave approximately the same way. Well, generally, I would not like to make it personal. but, of course, I would agree with you that the result of the voting of the second question was an enormous surprise to our opponents. You probably do remember that there was them, our most... the people who hated our government more than anybody, who insisted in the Supreme Soviet to include this question in the referendum. Now I think they are thinking how great fools they have made from themselves. Well, first of all, I would stress to your attention that the problems connected with the organized crime and the corruption are not unique in Russia. They are quite whispered in the world, and I cannot promise you that in Russia will be so different with all of the world that we will avoid these problems. What is especially, why these problems are especially serious now? First of all, because of the all of our law enforcement institution were adopted to quite another political reality. We were living in the closed police state, with the closed borders, with a strong passport control, where you cannot leave the city without the permission of the Ministry of Interior official. When if you are coming to Moscow, you have to register immediately, or any other city, etc. In the society in which there existed a very strong secret police, and every movement of the person was under observation, when the youth, for instance, and of the arms were very limited, etc. And all of our Ministry of Interior activity was accustomed to dealing with this kind of the society. Now the situation changed. There is no passport regime, there is practically no borders, there is no efficient secret police, etc. So they have to adapt to this new reality. We are trying to help them. From the only item in the budget on which we had not cut the expenditure in the absolute terms during the year 92 was the expenditure on the law enforcement. And I think it was a correct decision. We really will need to create for them possibility of adopting for the new situation. And they are moving in this direction, but it will need some time.
I think that perhaps we've kept Yegor long enough. This, of course, is only the end of the beginning, as Churchill said, and we will continue tomorrow and the day after. But before anyone goes, I just want to do two things. First, I want to apply some principles of the market economy. This document, which has nothing to do with this lecture, is called Russian Economic Trends.
and it appears monthly. It's produced with some help from LSE people by the Working Center for Economic Reform, which is the Russian government's economic think tank, which Yegor established when he came to office. The Economist has referred to this publication as a Bible for all observers of the Russian economy, as I think you may have read. And there are subscription forms around the place, and otherwise you can buy individual copies of the latest issue outside. It comes out once a month. But second, I want to thank Yegor. I think you've already shown what you felt about his lecture and about him. And I think that anybody who has seen the force of his intellect at work and his wonderful humanity can understand why he's been such a great reformer and such a great statesman. And I think we all want to thank him.
I don't know how you do it.